Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 138 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe, that's crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm. Or download the program after broadcast using iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me or use the link patreon.com/infectiousmyth. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on science, medicine, viruses, vaccines, democracy, or various social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. Cheryl McCumsey worked as a technologist in medical microbiology at the University of Alberta for many years. While working there, she had opportunities that included working on specimens from the Franklin expedition in the 19th century. After leaving this work, she enjoyed various jobs at Mountain Equipment Co-op, journalism, and now works as a registered massage therapist. She's the volunteer coordinator, or coordinator as a volunteer, for Pesticide-Free Edmonton, and for those who don't know, Edmonton is the capital of the province of Alberta in Canada. For the last 3 years, she's investigated local issues around pesticides while connecting to scientists around the world, providing insight into ways that will allow us to live in more harmony with our planet. Welcome to the show, Cheryl.
Hi, thank you.
So let's, we first kind of connected, I think you were talking about Roundup and glyphosate, which is used a lot. Again, not all our listeners will know too much about Alberta, but Alberta's mostly prairie, so there's a lot of grain growing, and I guess canola is not really a grain, it's actually a member of the mustard family, but it's used a lot, and I believe there's a lot of Roundup used in Alberta, and perhaps you can describe what Roundup is and what the purpose is of using it.
Certainly. So Roundup is a formulation. So a formulation means you have an active ingredient that does the action that you want. And so glyphosate is the active ingredient in Roundup. When we say formulation, we say that meaning that there are other things added into that product. It's interesting to note that when a pesticide is registered for use, the studies that are provided by the Industry to Health Canada, or the PMRA, the Pest Management Regulatory Agency, to register it, they only test the active ingredient, not the formulation. So this is really important because when we look at the additives into a formulation like Roundup, like there's surfactants added in there, these are things that help the pesticide adhere to a plant because Roundup is a herbicide, this makes it much more toxic than it would be on its own. So when people talk about glyphosate's toxicity as being low, it's interesting that we forget that the formulation is actually not tested when it's registered for use, and that's the way all our pesticides are tested in Canada.
And is this would this also be true in the United States, that they would only test the pesticide and not the so-called inert ingredients?
The active ingredient, yes. The active ingredient is tested. We don't really work independently. We work kind of in collaboration with the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. We don't really work independently. So right now, one of the pesticides also that's being discussed quite broadly in the U.S. is an active ingredient called chlorpyrifos, which has known links to serious neurological harm, especially in children. Lots of science around this, and this pesticide is, like, pesticides are supposed to be reevaluated every 15 years in Canada.
I appreciate you listening,
but that's not really happening. This was initiated back about 17 years ago by Health Canada, but never completed.
And so we will talk about
there was huge lawsuits in the U.S. around permanent
crops.
Neurological harm to families with children who were exposed to this in the home when there was household products still in use. So they were removed immediately, but they have never finished this evaluation. And so this pesticide is still used in agriculture, and there's many lawsuits in the U.S. trying to remove this because it's been actually recognized by their agency that it is harmful, but they still are dragging their heels in dealing with this and removing it.
And the indications are that under Donald Trump, there's going to be a lot less regulation. Like recently, they did something to stop the reexamination. I forget exactly what it was with chlorpyrifos.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it's a big deal because our city has used this. We're the only municipality in Canada, and from government reports and news,
the
reports,
only municipality in Canada that's used
Canada and
chlorpyrifos.
US. Yes, to use it inside our city for mosquitoes here, it's considered ineffective by most entomologists out there who look at how this impacts the predators, the mosquito. And mosquitoes often become very resistant to mm-hmm. it, and it becomes ineffective. So our city sprays this well within city boundaries. Even when Winnipeg was still using this, they stopped spraying it inside the city 10 years ago. We misapplied this according to federal law, and we reported this to Health Canada because it was sprayed in a park, which is against federal regulations. It says in the label it's not to be sprayed in a park. And the response we got was whether the park was actually a park. That was our first response. And we never really heard back from them if this was investigated. So we've really been working hard to get this issue out in the open because it shows how our federal agency, how our province, and how our governments are not really working to even adhere to our regulations as they are.
I interviewed a man one of my early episodes regarding the neonicotinoid pesticides, which have caused a lot of damage to bees. And he basically described, I think it was the Department of Agriculture, is basically working on behalf of the agricultural industry, like the producers of agricultural products, pesticides and fertilizers and things like that, and not acting on behalf of the farmers, the little guy. And I think that's true pretty much of both Canada and the U.S. is agencies like the Food and Drug Administration, Health Canada, the EPA, they tend to work on behalf of, to protect the industries as opposed to protect the citizens of our respective countries.
Yes, I think we really have to question all of this because, I mean, the audit that was done on Health Canada's Pest Management Regulatory Agency revealed 80 pesticides on the market that have not had the required science submitted, meaning they're on the market without science being submitted before they registered them, and 36 of those are neonics. And so we look at this issue, and then we look at the available science. Scientists around the world have said that neonics are 5 to 10,000 times more toxic than DDT.
They and particularly are, for bees and other beneficial insects.
Yes, insects in general, and mm-hmm. and that even in the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency has science that shows it does not improve yield. In the Europe, they have said that after this, you know, they've had a moratorium on neonics and have found that they haven't lost crops because they removed it. So it doesn't appear that it really does a lot. The thing to know that when we talk about integrated pest management, this is sort of a philosophy of how we're supposed to use pesticides. We use them as needed. Well, neonics are coated on the seeds of these plants, like canola, for instance, which is you know, grown in Alberta. The entire plant expresses this pesticide 24/7.
In other words,
all the time.
You plant seeds that have this pesticide in it, and you don't know what the environmental conditions will be, whether it's a wet year or dry year. You don't know what the pests are, but it's got the same pesticide in it no matter what, which is, I guess, a dream come true for the integrated pesticide seed manufacturers, right? Like you're buying seeds that contain the pesticides, presumably at an elevated price.
Well, it's important to note that if you're using a pesticide 24/7 all the time, this is not using as needed.
That's basically what I'm saying.
Pepsi is creates a condition as well where you become, if we talk about tools in the toolbox, this is a word that industry likes to, you know, describe how important it is that they have these tools in their toolbox. What they're actually doing is they create a condition where these tools become completely ineffective because they're using them all the time. And the same thing with genetic engineered crops that are designed to tolerate being sprayed with glyphosate. We're spraying this several times. I mean, one farmer described spraying Roundup, his neighbor sprayed Roundup, seven times in one season. Well, and industry continues to say that since they've introduced these crops that we use less
pesticides.
And that's completely false. I mean, I have the pesticide sales reports in front of me right here. We used in 1998 active ingredient of glyphosate in this province, the sales of that, 2,627,000 kilograms.
Right.
And 2013, almost three times as much, 8,667,000 kilograms.
Right. Okay, so let's go back to glyphosate. I remember the days when pesticides like 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T were used, and they were promoted because they were toxic to what we call the dicots, which are most flowering plants, but they weren't toxic to grasses. That was the deal then, and I don't know how true that was. But now we've got Roundup, which my understanding is it's a broad-spectrum pesticide. It kills everything. So explain how you can spray a pesticide like that without killing the crop as well as the weeds.
That's what these crops are designed to do. They're genetically engineered to tolerate being sprayed with this herbicide. So in the end, of course, you're going to have more of this on your crop. It's also sprayed on cereal crops at the end of the season. There are many...
So for that, actually, you spray pesticides on a crop that you're going to harvest because that basically kills the crop, dries it out, and then it's easier to harvest. Is that right?
Yeah, that's one of the ways that it's used. And, I mean, with the reports that came out recently, we are seeing levels that are above beyond acceptable levels in Canada. There's a man in British Columbia that has spent years trying to access reports to see the levels of glyphosate in our food. And it's apparent that, you know, it's not only just in our water. I mean, we have a lot of contamination of pesticides in our water and in our rain, but in our food at levels that are unacceptable. And this is all based on outdated science. There's lots of science coming out almost weekly about this herbicide because it's so broadly used around the world, linking it to all kinds of diseases, not just, you know, the probability that it's linked to cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but kidney and liver disease.
And we're talking about the entire pesticide. We're talking about Roundup, not glyphosate, right? Because glyphosate is this one part of what's sprayed. And so, it's easy to focus on the pesticide, but there could be something else in the formulation that's actually as toxic or more toxic or causes some different health condition.
Well, the formulation makes the product more toxic.
Right.
But studies are primarily done on glyphosate alone, like the ones that are linking to these other diseases. The fact is, it's very interesting for me, with my background, that if you look at the patent for glyphosate, when it was one of the patents for it, it lists all the microorganisms that it kills, and it lists all the normal gut flora that it kills. Those are what we require in our gut to digest our food. And when you look at the rates of gut diseases in Canada, we are a world leader for gut diseases.
Saw like a four-page spread on celiac disease in my newspaper about all the research and the drugs and stuff. Of course, no mention of the fact that gut diseases could be caused by pesticides, pharmaceuticals, other chemicals in our environment that just somehow gets neglected.
Well, I wonder if there's a certain amount of fear of even saying anything, because this industry certainly will go after anyone that stands up against.
Well, I think the medical charity industry is totally corrupt. It gets a lot of money basically from the industrial entities that are causing the problems. So they don't bite the hand that feeds them. I mean, it's notable that all medical charities promote pharmaceutical drugs. I don't think it's just a coincidence. You don't have the... I shouldn't say there's none, but when it comes to cancer charities and mental health charities, there's limited attention to like environmental conditions and a lot of attention on let's get better drugs, let's put more money into research for better drugs, things like that.
Well, some of the same companies that produce these chemicals also produce the drugs that treat the illnesses that these chemicals are related to.
It's a perfect system if you're a shareholder. I want to go back to this patent. Why would they have a patent touting a herbicide's potential for killing microorganisms? Like, what was the purpose of the patent?
I can't really answer to what the purpose was. I mean, I think the thought was that it would be maybe even used as a treatment, as a drug. But, of course, it's a broad-spectrum drug, which means it doesn't just kill one organism or two organisms. It kills gut flora. And
well, was it a patent?
I should mention there's a number of studies. They're not new studies that show that Salmonella, which is a pathogen, and other pathogenic organisms are more resistant to glyphosate.
Which isn't surprising, because they get to be problems because they are resistant to a lot of chemicals. But, I mean, this patent sounds like it was a patent for an antibiotic. It wasn't a patent for a herbicide.
Yes, this was. I think, let me just look here. I think it was 2002.
Right.
That this patent was registered.
I mean, if I was a chemical manufacturer and I had a chemical and I wasn't exactly sure what it did, I might patent a lot of different things, and you know, maybe I patent 20 different functions and maybe one or two of them pan out. But it's worrisome that this herbicide would have the side effect of killing microorganisms, because that's critically important to the health of the soil.
Exactly. Like, it's very interesting that some of the people who are working hard to develop systems that work better for farmers, where pesticides and chemical fertilizers almost become obsolete and unneeded, are looking at creating healthy soil by helping a farmer to create their own compost that they can put on their farmland that enhances the soil. The microorganisms in the soil are incredibly important. If you don't have them there, it's the same as not having gut flora. The plant cannot take up nutrients. It's not
right.
As healthy. It's more susceptible to diseases and pests. And so it's quite fascinating. What's really interesting is just recently, Monsanto has developed probiotics for the soil. It's a remarkable revolutionary thing when it's really not, but they're going to market it like it is.
Well, it's kind of, we destroy all the microorganisms in your soil, and then we're going to add in our patented, expensive, costly microorganisms into your sterile soil. How does the system work with farmers? Because, I mean, what you're saying is there's not a lot of huge benefits to these pesticides. There are alternatives. Why is it that farmers keep increasing their use? Every new pesticide that comes along seems to get a big market of farmers that want to use it.
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. I think, you know, people come across saying, you know, we're anti-science if we see an issue with pesticides or with genetically engineered crops, but it's actually the opposite. But, you know, when you use certain kind of language that the tobacco industry used to use, where, you know, we're fear-mongering, we're anti-science, and you use all kinds of marketing ploys and you make billions of dollars in profits, you can afford to manipulate information to make it seem that you have, you know, a better way, and this is marketed to farmers. And I mean, I have my own experiences where, you know, a farmer was not using very much in the way of pesticides, but it was still having some concerns around a potato crop and a particular pest. And so I just went and got a book about other methods of dealing with this pest and hand-delivered it to this farmer, and this farmer was ecstatic. And I was like, I'm not making any money.
Right.
Nobody is paying me, but it changed things for this farmer. And so it's really about information, and, you know, because there's probably not so much money to be made in doing things and teaching things another way. That's the system we're in.
Well, you think there would be overall, because if farmers find a better way, their crops have more value because they might be producing organic crops, and their input costs could be considerably less. So overall, agriculture would benefit, but it seems like this industry to produce chemicals for agriculture kind of has its hands around the throat of the government and around the farmers as well, somehow. It's
well, I would have to say that, yeah, I'd say our government is definitely, you know, when you just even read things that are produced by government and agriculture, it doesn't even really sound like independent information. It sounds like information you'd expect to hear from industry itself, just in the language that's used. And the way the systems are set up for subsidies, I mean, farmers get subsidies for no-till, right? And they're told that, you know, if they don't till the land, this is better for, you know, our carbon going into the atmosphere. Well, this is true,
right?
And this encourages the use of pesticides, and yet there are other agricultural ways of not tilling the soil that are better than using pesticides by far.
So no tilling for people who are not farmers. Like, normally in the spring, the soil will already have, like, weeds and stuff growing on it, so a farmer would plow the field, basically. It's tilling, right? And then they plow all of the weeds underneath, and so most of them would die, and then you end up with bare soil, which you can seed, right? So no-till is the seed goes in with the ground cover intact.
Yeah, like you're not tilling up the soil to remove the weeds, basically, which is organic traditionally would till to remove weeds.
So one way to do that would be like spray Roundup and then seed later? Is that?
Yeah, you might spray in the fall, right? And
right.
Then you'll spray on your crop as it's growing because it's genetically engineered and designed to tolerate that. The problem is now that we're having such serious weed resistance too, especially in Ontario, but it's, you know, starting to happen in Alberta here as well, is that now it's becoming ineffective in a very short period of time, really, since these crops have been introduced. And because we've been using it so much, now they're going to they're introducing new genetically engineered crops so they can spray both glyphosate and 2,4-D in combination, dicamba, which are, it's interesting to also note that combinations of pesticides are also never tested. So
dicamba, what is dicamba?
Dicamba is similar to 2,4-D in the way it works. So, and both of them persist actually a whole lot longer than most people understand them to. Like there was a study done in Calgary, it was about a little over a year ago, and they found 2,4-D in the air, like it's usually in a lawn chemical preparation,
mm-hmm.
In the air in April when it was sprayed the previous fall. So we're told, you know, there's a half-life in a lot of these things on the safety data sheets of maybe 6 days, but they persist far longer in the real world.
And is this due to the fact that they're testing, like if you test the active ingredient, that's one thing, but in the formulation maybe is designed to make it last longer?
Well, there's just so many factors there. You have, you know, your soil and your environment in itself, the conditions that it's in. If your soil's been repeatedly sprayed with a pesticide, you're not going to have, especially glyphosate, you're not going to have soil microbes there. They're just not going to be there anymore to break down.
Oh, okay. So that's another consequence of getting rid of the soil microbes is that the toxic chemicals you're putting in the soil aren't getting eaten up by some tough bacteria that are able to process some of the chemicals and part of the pathway to degrade them into something less toxic.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, there's lots of different studies, they're not all new either. Some of this is not new information. There's also information about how spraying glyphosate sets up more diseases for crops. Like in Saskatchewan, there's a recent story that came out in a Western Producer stating how fusarium, which is a fungal disease on wheat, seems to be a real problem there, except for organic farmers. For some reason, this isn't a problem for organic farmers.
Wait a minute. It's supposed to be the opposite, right? It's supposed to be the organic farmers who aren't using pesticides who have all the issues. And you're saying here's an example of a disease that's attacking crops of farmers who use pesticides.
Well, I don't know why anybody would even think organic has more diseases.
Well, I mean,
how would an organic farmer even manage a business if they have more problems with pests?
Well, there's actually simple logic, right? Like bear with me for a moment. So if a pesticide has a single purpose, which is to kill, say, insects, and I've got two farmers, and one uses the pesticide designed to kill insects, then the conclusion is that farmer using pesticides will have less insect problems than the one who doesn't. That seems like simple logic. The organic farmer not using insecticides should have more insect problems.
I like to draw an analogy with human health.
Mm-hmm.
If you are constantly taking a drug, let's give this example. You go to your pediatrician with your child. Your doctor says to you, I want you to give this drug to your child for the rest of their life, just in case they get sick. And by the way, most people in the world think this pesticide or this drug is very harmful. There's evidence that it doesn't work. But the industry says it's good. So I want you to give this to your child for the rest of your life. What would you say?
Well, some parents would say yes. but it would not be a sane thing to do. I mean, I think, let's take the analogy of antibiotics. We know now that if you give antibiotics at the slightest sign of, say, an ear infection or something like that, you end up with more problems. The child is more likely to have infections that are resistant to antibiotics, so when you actually need them, they don't work as well. And I guess that probably goes with pesticides. If you use pesticides routinely without actually having a problem, or you use them more and more frequently, you may get more and more problems that are more and more resistant to pesticides. So it's a treadmill.
It's like thinking differently. If you really want to understand the differences here, it's our frame of thinking. So an organic farmer, a really good organic farmer, I mean, they're not all the same, but
right.
The ones that practice organic, the way, you know, the philosophy of it and the caring, it's about taking care of the soil. Healthy soil gives you the equivalent of a healthy plant. A healthy plant is not going to have issues with diseases and pests.
That makes sense. And it's a sense of stability. Like I think one of the characteristics of modern industry, whether it's medicine or agricultural industries or whatever, is always focused on growth, produce more, better, bigger, whatever, whereas organic seems more like let's keep the soil in a static condition of health, and then every year we can produce the same crop, right?
Well, the other thing that's very important is as we go forward and we're going to have more problems with climate change, which means more severe weather. We had 6 agricultural disasters in Alberta with too much rain. And I'm not saying that this would have solved that problem, but most of our farmers in Alberta are not looking at these systems of agriculture. So if you've depleted your soil of organic matter, when you get too much rain, your soil's not going to take that water up.
Well, I think Alberta over history has had a lot of droughts and a lot of floods. I mean, it is a place, I mean, until people have lived in Alberta, they don't quite realize just how dramatic the weather swings are, because we don't have the kind of weather that kills you. We don't get a lot of tornadoes and things like that, but we have huge temperature swings and huge swings from dry to wet. That's just part of Alberta climate. It has been for a long time.
It is. I mean, it has historically, but if going forward, we're looking at more severe weather, more severe drought, more torrential downpours. Like, severe weather is what we could be facing, or whether you don't believe that, if you want land that's going to handle those kinds of fluctuations, you need organic matter in the soil. And I've gone out to farms. I'm not just like, you know, reading the science about this, but I'm actually going out to farms where the farmer is addressing his soil completely different way. And you can see that that soil is going to retain moisture during times of drought,
right,
going to handle the excess water in times of too much rain. So,
right,
you know, for the farmer, it works above and beyond just saving money on pesticides. And
well, also, should benefit society, because, I mean, the problem with floods is if you have a lot of paved land or a lot of land that can't hold water, then your floods are going to be worse.
Exactly.
And so farmers who have soil that can absorb a lot of water and hold it for some period of time before it gets released back into the system are actually going to be participating in mitigating the effects of flooding.
Yeah, and if you look at history, too, I mean, in China, when they had, a decision that they were going to remove sparrows because the sparrows were eating the grain, and then they didn't have sparrows to eat insects, and then they did have, they believed this had an impact on the famine that happened there. If you wipe out all insects, you're not just wiping out the ones you don't want. You're wiping out beneficial insects. So instead of always focusing on what we don't want, we should be focusing on what's wrong. Just like with our own health. Most of us, if we care a lot about our own personal health, if a doctor just gives us a drug and does not address the cause of an illness, you are not necessarily going to be healed. If you haven't...
Yes, that's probably the majority of the time is it's the symptoms that are being addressed. And again, like if you go to Monsanto and say, I have a problem with my crops every year, what's the solution? Well, they're either going to give you a fertilizer or a pesticide or a new seed, right? They're not going to give you a more creative answer than that. They're going to tell you, here's what we got on the shelf. One of these will solve your problem, whether it will or not. And a lot of pharmaceutically oriented doctors are the same way. It's not the question of what's the best treatment for your condition. It's the question of what drug best matches your symptoms.
Yeah, I had a good conversation with a farmer not too long ago where he's having conversations with other farmers, and their farmers are saying things to him, and he's saying, well, your problem isn't that you need to spray this or spray that. Your problem starts with the soil, really.
Right.
It starts with the soil and what condition your soil is in and the health of your plant. So, like, you know, I haven't looked at this in great detail yet, but a lot of farmers are taking measurements with this instrument. It's called BRICS. It's the sugar content in the plant, and the higher the sugar content, which makes sense, the healthier the plant. And he was talking to one farmer who was having some insects on the leaves of his wheat on the stalk of the wheat as opposed to the grain itself. Well, the BRICS content in the grain was good, but in the stalk of the plant, it was poor. So he was like, there you go. That's evidence that, you know, if you have a healthy plant, you won't have pests. You might have some, but you're not going to have, you're not going to lose your whole crop to something because your plants are healthy. And when you start looking at the science, it's really quite fascinating. It is true that, you know, if you're generally unhealthy, you're more prone to all kinds of diseases and sicknesses than if you're healthy.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the body is a series of tightly integrated functions, and the idea that you've got a heart and a lung and a stomach and they're all separate things and you can treat them separately is obviously not true. There's no drug that goes into your bloodstream and doesn't affect multiple organs, if not most or all organs. Is there a trend in Alberta towards a greater acceptance of organic crops, of a reduction in the use of chemical inputs? Do you see any trends in that direction?
By our government, no. Does the public desire it in general? I would say yes. Organic is the fastest growing market in the industry. You only have to go into a store and see the difference and what was there 5 years ago, that there is a demand for something else, and it seems like our government's completely ignoring that. Some farmers are trying to provide food to us. We import a lot more than we used to when it comes to history. We're heading down a really dangerous road because 75% of farmers out there today are planning to retire in the next 10 years. What are we going to replace this with?
Well, big industrial farms, I guess.
And this puts us at a huge risk nationally and locally, because if you look at California, I mean, we import a lot of our food. California has had a very long-term drought. They're big concerns about how many species of bees they're losing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they're going to feed us first before they feed themselves? I mean, and when we're looking forward too with issues around, you know, our energy use and stuff, if we're growing food that we're going to eat locally, food that's healthy and requires less chemical inputs. And when you look at chemical fertilizers, too, that's a really big one that affects climate change. When we're talking about climate change, that seems to be one that we skip over all the time, is chemical fertilizers and what that produces, right, into the atmosphere. So if we want to move forward and have food sovereignty for all of us, we need to be looking at how we do agriculture in this province, and maybe we're going to have to do that without the government, because the government's really not listening to us.
Well, I think the North American, I mean, it's not just North American, but there's sort of this laziness that we want somebody to look after this, but we don't want to pay them, and that's why, you know, television is generally supported by advertising, because we want all these programs, but we don't want to actually pay for them, so we will accept huge amounts of advertising. And here it's like, well, we don't want to pay more to our government to give us better information, so we'll just let the industry sort of subsidize the government and give us the information they want to give us, as opposed to the government actually doing research. Like, if you said, let's set up a major new government-sponsored research institute for low-input agriculture, you know, organic, lower pesticides, lower fertilizers, et cetera, people would say, where's the money going to come from, right? But where does the money come from for the information we're getting from the profits, massive profits of the industrial agricultural lobby?
Well, I don't think people realize what's happened. I mean, it's because it takes a lot of research to look and see where our tax money's going, for instance. I mean, in Alberta here, we got all really upset about 5% carbon tax, but I'm shocked that people are not upset about $3 billion in subsidies going to the oil industry.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the oil industry was actually a profit-making venture. I don't know why they need to be subsidized. I mean, it's not like oil is a new compound that people don't know how to deal with. I think we need to, you know, it's reasonable to subsidize new industries such as wind and solar, because we see the public good, and obviously the first players in that industry are going to have a lot of extra costs as they go down dead ends and stuff in order to try to improve their products. But to subsidize,
we certainly have this going on with the chemical industry as well.
Mm.
But people are not aware of it. They aren't aware of how the money goes into these industries, and then how these industries decide how they're going to give that money back to us, how they see fit. So, you know, we have lack of funding to our universities, and we see big chemical corporations now funding our universities and influencing, literally influencing science. I mean, I've been in some lectures at the U of A that if other people were sitting there listening to some of the things that were said, they'd be shocked. You know, they'd be shocked at the things that were shared. I mean, we had a professor from the States come to the U of A to speak. His name is Jason Lusk, and he co-authors with a man called Glenn Miller. Glenn Miller still writes for the tobacco industry about how tobacco is harmless. So, I mean, how far are we going to go? But these people write, co-author things together on genetically engineered crops and how we need to use genetic engineering to feed the world and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, let's talk about that because, yeah. I mean, one of the things about Roundup is it basically forces the farmer into using genetically modified crops. Right? You can't use Roundup with normal crops because they'll die. So what are your concerns around GMO crops?
Well, most of them are designed to withstand being sprayed with glyphosate, which has, you know, it's just really linked. There are two issues that are totally linked, pesticide use and genetic engineering.
Mm-hmm.
There are other crops being introduced that are genetically engineered, like the Arctic apple. But then when you actually do some research, I did some research in the genetically engineered apple, and I found 10 good reasons not to introduce this apple.
And which, what are some of those reasons?
Well, first of all, the enzyme that's silenced in the apple, which prevents it from browning, actually, in science, shows it prevents fungal disease. So the apple has a natural resistance to fungal disease with this enzyme. Without, it doesn't have that resistance.
Okay, so now you need to spray a pesticide to...
You might, yeah.
Because you might get this fungal disease. Okay, and so another...
Again, why do we need a non-browning apple? We have, like, 8 varieties of apple that resist browning.
So basically, that means if you cut the apple and leave the flesh in the air, it will brown. But you can actually sprinkle some lemon juice on it, right, to stop that. Or you can just not care about it because it still tastes like an apple, even if it's gone brown, right?
Yes. So, like, there's no reason to even have this apple on the market, right? Then the other concern is, I mean, there's other concerns with new genetically engineered crops. I mean, it's quite complex and hard for people to understand. But most of our genetically engineered crops require an antibiotic-resistant gene as a marker. So what they do is they take the DNA and they put a marker on it, an antibiotic-resistant gene, in this case, kanamycin.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they take that plant and put it in a petri dish, like a plant cell, they can see if the DNA took or not, because they put kanamycin in the petri dish. If the plant cell grows, then they know then that it took.
Oh, okay. So the
very precise science. They hold it so precise. But
well, let me try to. That's complicated. So basically, the plant cells or the plant DNA contains an antibiotic resistant gene. So if you add the antibiotic, then you kill everything else, but these cells will remain. So what's the impact of that in the field?
See, this is a thing that is unknown and untested. They're not tested. So kanamycin is used in the treatment of serious diseases like tuberculosis. It's given intravenously. So tuberculosis is just one example. Tuberculosis is on the rise, becoming more resistant to antibiotics, and kanamycin is still important in its use of treatment. That's just one of the diseases it's used for. So what you could be doing, I mean, this is when you study how bacteria become resistant and how they transfer that information to one another to become resistant to antibiotics, this is a big concern.
So they could pick up this gene.
Something that has a risk, for what reason?
Right, right. It could pick up the gene from the plant somehow, and then bingo, all of a sudden you have another antibiotic that doesn't work anymore.
Yes, the possibility is there. It's not a for sure thing one way or another.
Well, we shouldn't have to be in a position where we have to prove that something's bad. If there's legitimate concerns, we should take our time and try to see if it's a problem before just going ahead. And then by the time you discover it's a problem, it's too late to
Well, this
reverse
is kind
course.
Of the way it's been for some time now, is that we don't even properly sit back and take our time about whether something should even be introduced. I mean, one of the things is the apple growers in the region where they want to grow this apple did not want this. Consumers overwhelmingly did not want this. So, you know, and the one of the reasons being is apple growers are concerned about cross-contamination with this apple. So, you know, anybody who wants to say they're not selling a non-genetically engineered apple because people have their own concerns.
Right.
Based on science, not based on...
I don't really care. If you don't want to eat GMO crops, it should be your right. Whether it's a completely irrational belief, whether it's a religious belief or whatever, it's like nobody should be forced to eat GMO crops. And you're basically saying if there's cross-contamination, you might buy something that's organic, GMO-free, but actually it has a GMO element in it from cross-contamination.
It has a bigger impact on farmers and their market internationally. And this has happened with contamination of genetically engineered wheat that was, you know, like they've done trials of genetically engineered wheat. And somehow, we still don't know how that happened. There was contamination, and that affected a market, and there was genetically engineered flax that affected a market. Some farmers have lost a lot of money. Millions and millions of dollars have been lost because of the concerns around this around the world. Most people, most countries do not allow these crops to grow within their borders and don't want them.
Right, right. Europe is definitely more progressive on this issue than North America, even though it's still, I'm sure, heavily influenced by the chemical industry.
Yes, like when I'm looking at people who are supportive of this, you know, and you look back, you'll see they're linked to this industry. And then the people who, a lot of us, are just simply repeating what we've heard over and over again. We just are repeating the same words that have been marketed to us over and over again, without question, without looking. I mean, I don't know how anyone without a science background would be able to read and understand the concerns. So it's very easy to make this a big myth, the concerns about
right.
when they're completely valid, because it takes, I mean, I know if I did not have the background that I have in medical microbiology, I would not be able to understand what I'm reading.
Right, and it's very easy for somebody with a vested interest to interpret the literature in a way that's beneficial to them, knowing that most people won't be able to contradict that because they won't be able to get into the literature.
Or even know where to look for it. I mean, one of the things we hear over and over and over again is genetically engineered crops have reduced the use of pesticides. Well, it's completely false. And it's false because all the evidence that's there says something else. It's even, you know, when they talk about using less harmful pesticides. Well, in Alberta, we don't use a lot of atrazine, but we've pretty much doubled the use of it in that same time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a herbicide, right? So,
I mean, is there a government policy or program to gradually reduce the use of pesticides, or they're completely out of the business of trying to direct the market in that way?
In Alberta, I really can't say that there's anything like this other than what farmers and people are really doing on their own. I think, you know, that there are groups like Permaculture who look at this a more holistic way. They don't even look at it as just farming, but a holistic way of how we look at farming and our environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who are interested in organic crops are also interested in the economic system, like who's working on the farm, what are they getting paid, what are the conditions, things like that. Like people want to buy foods that they feel comfortable with, not just what's in the food, but also the whole production cycle. If you're an organic farmer in Alberta, are you pretty much on your own? Like you have to go to your own organizations to get assistance? Like, are you going to get some help from the provincial government?
Well, there are, I haven't read these fully, but there are some things that the National Farmers Union has written on concerns about these programs and how they help young new farmers. A lot of our farmers that are interested in this have no previous background with farming. So for them to access subsidies and things like that, it requires a lot of paperwork.
Right.
If you're a big farmer and you got a lot of money, you could probably hire people to do some of these things for you. So it really does not support organic young farmers the same way. I mean, we're told that it does, but in essence, in reality, it doesn't support them the same way. As far as I know, like I can't say I know about everything, but and I know some young farmers who, you know, who seem to be doing fairly well. But I think they've also got family that's been in the farming industry for a number of years and kind of know what they're.
Yeah, it's not a good sign if the farmer population is aging. I mean, that is another part of the sustainability, right? If you don't have the children of farmers going into farming, or you don't have people whose families aren't farmers going into it anew, then eventually there's going to be a crisis with the farming industry. And like I said, the logical conclusion of that is that the big industrial concerns will snap up all of those fields and plant heavily chemicalized monocultures.
Yeah, I'm very concerned that, you know, we could have a collapse of this system anytime. I mean, maybe not 5 years. Maybe next year we're going to see some serious problem because we're growing huge expansive fields of one thing.
Right, and so you get a new pest that comes in. It can destroy everything, like the Great Potato Famine, which supposedly was caused by the Colorado beetle, but really it was caused by Ireland having too much of a monoculture of potatoes.
Yes, like when we talk about diversity, well, these, you know, genetically engineered crops are not providing any kind of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Providing one kind of seed to do one thing, and there's all kinds of concerns around that we won't have time to discuss, but, you know, you have one herbicide canola seed over how many heck acres in Alberta, you know, and then you have neonics, which have, you know, I know that we have less insects in this province, and it's, mm-hmm. it's definitely have a number of birds that are being threatened. We're told, oh, you know, it's a cat population. I'm like, well, we've always had cats. Cats have always eaten birds. But what we've changed is we've removed the food source for a number of birds in this province, and so we have many birds which are threatened in this province now. We're creating conditions for a failure.
Right. I think that's true. We're running out of time. We've come close to the end of the show. So are there a couple more things you'd like to say before we end?
Well, I think people, yeah, the biggest thing to me is to be questioning everything. Question the source of information and question why we still are focused on removing or killing something and why we're not looking at why this thing is there that we don't like. A dandelion is telling you something about the soil.
Yeah, that's, I noticed that when I would, on a street I lived on, there would always be dandelions at the top of the hill where the grass was cut. But down on the hill, which nobody did anything with, there was huge variety of plants and there were no dandelions. The dandelions only appeared where there was annual, you know, frequent mowing. They just kept coming back and coming back, and sometimes there'd just be this white sea of dandelion seeds, whereas 3 feet away there'd be deep native grass and wildflowers, and nobody did anything in that area.
Now we have to question why we hate the dandelion so much, and who told us we should hate it, and why we learned that, and why, you know, why it's there. I mean, this one woman who does teach farmers how to make a compost that addresses the soil, and it's the need for there to be microbes there, did this in Boston when there was a drought, and there was all these brown yards, and then this very green yard where they put this compost down, extremely green, so green that the cops were out there day and night waiting to watch to see when they were going to water, when they weren't watering.
Oh, just because of better soil quality, yes. I think people are gradually getting the message that organic farming is not just some, like, idealistic hippie thing that it actually works. And you can see the products in the store now. It used to be you had to go out of your way to see organic food. But now if you go to a main grocery store like Safeway, you see a large organic aisle. So I think people realize that, yeah, you can make money making organic, and maybe it has a lot of benefits for the environment and for society in general as well.
Yeah, and the price, you know, if you learn how to shop, I think we actually, in our household, we eat 100% organic now, and I think we spend less money on food and we eat better.
Well, the big cost of food is processed food, right? Like if you buy oven-ready pizzas and things like that, that's way more expensive than actually buying organic flour and making the pizza yourself.
Yeah, and there's other, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things I've learned. I mean, just buying dried organic chickpeas or something, you can have a case or a dozen cans
right.
of chickpeas for $6. I mean,
right, right. It's
protein.
Yes. Huh? Yeah, price is really just an excuse not to do it. Anyway, I'd like to thank you for joining me today, Cheryl. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you very much, David.
Okay.
Goodbye
then. Bye-bye. Speaking of farming, one of the listeners of the show, John Watling from the United Kingdom, is an advocate for not killing badgers in England because of TB. He has a letter in a newspaper called The Farmer's Guardian. My writings, he says, claim bovine TB is not coming into the body from outside, but it is coming out, and TB is a natural immune response. The mistake is to translate an immune response into a disease, which is not the case. He talks about a particular farmer whose cows tested positive for TB. He says, when we inject a cow with foreign matter, the so-called skin test, the immune system will detect the matter and then try to repair it, eating it up or walling it off, which it does by generating bacteria from within in the sense of an internal metamorphosis, according to Professor Bechamp from the 19th century. This is the beginning of TB. It means it's coming from within, not from outside, meaning it is not infectious. The mode of transmission, which is believed to be badger to cow, remains unknown, according to Professor David MacDonald at the University of Oxford. Blaming environmental bacteria is the wrong model, and to slaughter cows or badgers based on a test which generates TB through foreign matter contained in the injection itself is not rational. Academia has this process the wrong way round. Thank you for joining me for episode 138 of The Infectious Myth. If you've got a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. You can commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.